Okay, I'll do this again. My name is Tom, and I'm an alcoholic. Okay. I'm a big book thumper from Santa Fe, New Mexico. I've been sober since June the 15th of 1986, and my home group is called AA Group in Santa Fe. We meet at 7 o'clock on Monday nights at the Salvation Army, and everyone here is invited. Okay. Let's have a moment of silence and open in the more or less traditional way. This meeting is called, I assume everyone's here because there's sex in the title. Is that pretty much right? My friend Mary Thayer said, "When are you doing that sex thing?" I said, "I'm not." Anyway, we have Peggy B. from New York. We have Ken. Okay, hold it down. We have Ken B. from New Jersey. And Sarah H. from New York. And we're going to start off with Peggy B. She's going to speak for about 20 minutes.
Good morning. Good morning. My name is Peggy Byrne. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is March 20. Oh, dear.
Is that right?
My name is Peggy Byrne. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is March 21st, 1973. I belong to the Atlanta Group in New York City. I have a sponsor. Her name is Peggy M. She lives in Nebraska. And if you didn't hear her today, get the tape. It was, like, amazing. I want to thank, first off, Rick for inviting me, Rick Walker, thank you. You know, I said, gee, how am I going to, you know, fill 20 minutes on this topic? And Sarah, who's so kind, said, just start off with all your lovers. So, you know, oh, if but that were true. This room is filled with a number of my heroes in the program and my so many beloved sponsees and grand sponsees and great grand sponsees. The great grand ones are the ones that jump up. They're the and my prayer partners are dotting the room. It can be pretty emotional just looking out at you all, beloved friends. You know, last night I looked out in the stadium and I looked out and I thought, my God, I could have missed this. I could have missed it. I could have said, I won't go to that meeting. Instead, I'll try to get a few pills. Maybe that'll do the thing. Or maybe I'll wait a week. I could have missed it. And I didn't miss it. By the hand of God, I got here, and look what I found. It's like so totally amazing. Now, really, really, really. I made some notes because what happens is I can do a qualification and get totally lost in it, so that's not fair. The other thing that I wanted, you know, I came in 73, and 75 was Denver. I missed it because I thought, oh, 25,000. I think it was either 20 or 25,000. Oh, too many people. Too many. I'm claustrophobic. And then there was New Orleans, and I thought, 30,000? I don't think so. I don't think so. And then I was asked to do a workshop in Montreal, and I went in 85. I was not off that plane 5 minutes when I looked around and I said, Lord, you know, I will never, ever miss another international. I will come here. I will come here. I will come here on a walker, and believe me, I will. And all those great grand sponsees are going to be just scared of me and wheeling the chair and wheeling the walker. But I just quick want to talk about that first. In Montreal, I was asked to do a workshop, and the workshop was intergroups and central offices. And what it was an information meeting, and I was the qualifier, but they didn't know they were going to have a qualifier. So everybody was talking about sales tax, leasing problems, major thing, rental, big stuff. How they could, they were, at that time there was little concern, maybe IRS was going to ask for a report, and it was going, people raising their hands, I don't want, fighting. And then they said, and now we're going to have Peggy, who came up through the system. She called into group, she got sober, she then came back and volunteered and did it. I think at that time it was like 5 years I interviewed, of course, I was always interviewing, and volunteered at Intergroup. Well, they were so excited that they were not going to hear sales tax and leasing problems that they started to cheer. You would have thought Clancy was going to speak. I mean, it was amazing. I was, and of course, I told funny stories about Intergroup. Okay, now let's get to sex, security, and society. We were made by God to be social creatures. We absolutely were. And we all need people as little children. And what we want is we want to be so part of something. Whether it be the family, the clan, the club, the organization. So my first foray into an organization, I was 12 years old, and I finally got into the Girl Scouts. I was on a waiting list, and now I got to be a Girl Scout. And what was my job? I collected dues. I went up and down the line and collected the dues. And I think the dues was 5 cents. And God help you if you didn't have that 5 cents. So I walked up and I said, oh, Mary Lou, you don't have it? Well, I better not see you at Sweetland later having a pineapple temptation. I absolutely terrified this. I terrified them. I threatened them. They were threatened. And you know what? I have not changed that much. I absolutely have not, I belong to the Atlantic Group. We're a very structured group, and our finances are very, very structured. And I appointed myself CFO many, right after we founded the group. That was the beginning of belonging, and there was definitely a sense of belonging. And in belonging, there's always security. You are secure. You know that when you go there, you belong. People are listening to you. People are waiting for you. And the thing is, God then creates us for intimacy. We move on from that into intimacy. The problem with alcohol, for an alcoholic, there's nothing wrong with alcohol, but for an alcoholic, alcohol actually damages and then almost really destroys intimacy. It destroys the ability to have relationships. What it does is it starts to fray at the connectedness for us. And how that manifests itself is very often sexually. And we act out sexually, and we use people sexually, and we become used sexually. So actually, what's so incredible is we come into this program and we have this design for living, which is our 12 steps. And certainly when we get to that fourth step where we actually see the pattern of our lives sexually, And that gets, it gets worked out. We actually see it. And then we have a loving sponsor who will tell us some of her horror stories and make us feel good and think of, you know, and there's, yes, and then we feel we're not, we're really not so bad. So actually it does, it restores, definitely restores our life. And now being, I want to mention what happens when we're in a group, we join the group, we get a commitment. That is, you know, totally, that commitment actually is saying to us, this meeting cannot go on unless you're here for your commitment. So my first commitment, I was director of refreshments at the Midtown Group. Now, how did I get that job? I was sober 3 days. It was my third meeting. Sober a week because I didn't think I needed Alcoholics Anonymous, whatever that was. You know, I didn't think. I remember we didn't have much information in the 70s. But so this is now my third meeting that someone recommended, the Midtown Group, which this is where the Atlanta Group is now. I mean, this is all divinely inspired. Everything happens. There is not one wasted thing that happens in Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything from the minute you walk into that group, nothing is wasted. You get the commitment. That commitment will let you go on in life, will let you go on in your job. You know how important it is to be that person. But how I got that, they said, Rex is leaving, he's going into the hospital, and we need some volunteers to do coffee. And about 70, it appeared to me, probably 80 people in the room, but it appeared to me that 70 people raised their hand. And I raised my hand, didn't know what it was. I certainly knew how to make coffee, not knowing that the pots were like these giant. And they said, all right, meet us after the meeting. And after the meeting, these 70 people, 30 showed up. And the 30 were told, okay, you can do the coffee. We have two meetings. You have to get here at 5 o'clock. And there, and they showed us the back room. And so now I say to him, all right, we'll all meet here. I get there, two of us showed up. Now, why, I ask you, why did God love me? Why did he pick me out? Why did he love me so much to give me that job? The two of us, and we did it for a year and three months. But when I was doing it 2 weeks, this woman who was to become my sponsor said, we had a special meeting last night. I actually believed her. We had a special meeting, and we said, we're going to name her Director of Refreshments. We'll name her. And I had a pretty good title at that time, worked for an ad agency. I think manager of officer. And I said, do you think I'm sober enough for this job? Me? I'm not. She said, yes, you have to be here at 5. You probably won't leave till 11. I said, no, no problem, sir. No problem. Now, that was not the person that came in this room. You know, I was not, you know, I was always a good person. But, you know, I wasn't going to be volunteering to make coffee and stay from 5 to 11. That wasn't my thing. But, you know, when did I fall in love with Alcoholics Anonymous? Was it that twinkle in your eye? You know, that you were sitting there in the first row and I passed by and I said, I'm new, and you were twinkling? You know, was that? The thing is, what was it? When did I dare to trust? You know, when was it something? When did I fall in love? I think I fell in love that first night. But, you know, when did I know that the Master was here, that he was in that room, that he came? God is at every meeting. There's no question about it. But I did not know that, and I'll tell you my regret after 37 years, that it took me too long to find out that he was in charge of my life. It took me too long. Now, I did find out Maybe I found out when I was sober 5 years ago. I don't know. But at some point, I knew instantly that my life was in his care, that all I had to do was pray for faith, to pray for, sometimes pray for injections of faith, because, you know, life is hard. Get up in the morning, look in the mirror, and you have to say, life is hard, God. Life is hard. What are we going to do today to make it easier? How are you going to use me? Which is why, you know, prayer is so essential to us. You know, when did I know? Every instinct in me, every single instinct said, do you want to be secure? Do you really want to be secure and a member of society? Well, align your will with mine, Peggy. And it will be beyond your wildest dreams. Now, my experience, 37 years of it, I jumped on that pink cloud. I always say this. I jumped and I never got off. And that pink cloud has gone like this, like this, like this. And I have been totally secure. Totally. Life goes on. I mean, so now what I say is whenever there's something, and things, you know, life can be difficult. And I think, what is your plan? You know, there is some purpose here. And I know you want me to be this very secure member of society, God. So what is your plan for me today? And of course, on the prayer wheel, that is, you know, one of the things that that I pray for, and all our prayer partners pray for. It wasn't the cash and prizes that gave me all these incredible feelings. It was not. And they come. Let me tell you, when you're sober, the big jobs come. You know, fame and fortune is there. Definitely there. The work is those spiritual muscles. Make no mistake. Developing those spiritual muscles on a daily basis. And that really is where all the joy is. It really, it truly is. I think I've really said all I can say about since. Oh, and let me just say this about, you know, sex, that I'm going to give you a little thing on sex. I sponsor women that have had more sex in 1 month than I had in a 15-year marriage. Okay? That's my peak. Okay? Look. And that really is my piece about sex. And I want to hear, it really is. But who knows, if I play my cards right, you never know. But I want to end my talk with a piece that was it's in our book about the medical view on Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was written by Dr. Foster Kennedy, a famed neurologist, in 1944. And is actually in the back of our fourth edition. The organization of Alcoholics Anonymous calls on two of the greatest reservoirs of power known to man, religion and that instinct for association with one's fellows called the herd instinct. I think our profession must take appreciative cognizance of this great therapeutic weapon. If we do not do so, we shall stand convicted of emotional sterility and of having lost the faith that moves mountains. Without that, medicine can do little. And what he was talking about was the herd instinct of how, because we are all together, we get well and we learn from each other. So I thank you for coming. Thank you.
Hold your ears for just a minute while I fix this microphone. All right. We now have Ken B. from Montclair, New Jersey.
Hey, everyone, I'm Ken. I'm an alcoholic. And I am indeed the only one on the panel not from New York City, from the North American mainland. And I'm proud of it these days. But I have to come clean. I got sober in New York City, and I was born in New York City. And I also have to own up to a little chip on my shoulder when I moved across the river, coming from meetings in New York City, that I knew it all, and I knew better. You know, because I went to meetings a few blocks from General Service and a few blocks from incredible meetings like the Atlantic Group. And I finally had to own up to the fact that I was a Jersey guy. And my sobriety date is April 15th, 1986. My home group, I have a home group in New Jersey. It's Circle of Friends, and we have some members here, I'm happy to say, from Circle of Friends in West Orange, New Jersey. And I do work in New York City, and I keep my hand in New York City AA by attending the 22nd Street Sobriety Group every Tuesday night. And I'm going to be chairing for the next 6 months. If anyone's passing through, I need a speaker. Tuesday at 6 p.m. Please see me after the meeting. I was at this panel 5 years ago in Toronto, and it was a very amazing experience for me, because a little kid I grew up with in the Bronx was on this panel. His name was Scott Redmond. And I identify him that way because if you get the CD, that's how he identifies himself. And I think Scotty, I had no idea he was in AA. I had no idea he was a well-known speaker. And it was pretty amazing to come to Toronto and discover all that. And when I went up to him after the meeting, he almost fell over. We played Little League together. And I think he had something to do with my being here today. I really do. Because I got up here, and if you want to speak at one of these sessions, you just got to ask. If you want to do service, put your hand up and ask. And having gotten sober in New York City, I knew who to ask. But I, being a little bit of a, having a fancy graduation, as a fancy education, as my first sponsor used to say, I fancy myself a bit of a scholar on history, and I wondered if anyone had ever spoken about William James at the convention. He was the guy who wrote the book that Bill read when he was in one of his stays at Towns Hospital, and that book talks a lot about the need for calamity, as James called it, and we call it a bottom, for certain people to have a spiritual experience. And so that was my proposed topic. And I communicated that to a beautiful guy named Doug R., who works at GSO. And he listened, and he said, "You want to speak?" I said, "Well, I'm interested in speaking on that topic." He said, "Well, send me an email." And I forgot about that conversation. And in March, I got a letter that said, "We're inviting you to speak on a panel called Sex, Security, and Sobriety and Society." And I was, I had to, think, Scotty, it's got to be your doing. But I think if you put the word sex before any of our meetings, it'd get quite a turnout. In fact, my next GSR report, I might call it Sex and the GSR. If you want to see people run from a meeting, come to GSR report, especially when your job is to explain the topics that they're going to go over at the General Service Conference in New York. The eyes glaze over. But I, I, uh, It's a beautiful thing to be here, and I have some friends here from New Jersey and from New York and friends of friends. And I'm grateful I got sober in New York City because you don't need a car to go to meetings. And you can walk to meetings. We have public transportation. And, you know, my beautiful sponsor, Alan M., he used to tease me about my fancy education. He said, trouble with you is you're too smart. And what you need to do is get smart feet. And those feet took me to a lot of meetings. And what got me to my first meeting was really, you know, like all of us, we had some tough times. With me, it was physical problems. My physical health in my early mid-30s started falling apart as a result of the use and abuse of alcohol and, you know, little white powder and things you roll up and light up. And, you know, I thought I was in great shape, and I was shocked when a doctor I was referred to, you know, for symptoms other than drinking. I won't go into the specifics, but it was a result of the lifestyle I was living. And, you know, he told me that, you know, my liver was enlarged. And, you know, he wanted to know how much I imbibed, being, you know, one of those fancy Park Avenue doctors. He, you know, introduced the subject very gently about alcohol use. And that was really the beginning of this journey for me. And, yeah, I'm very grateful to have met a medical practitioner who understood alcoholism and could spot a drunk when he walked into his office and was generous enough to take the time to really go through what alcoholism is. And I remember he told me that people who become dependent on alcohol and drugs are people that never learned to be dependent in a healthy way on other people. And that definition really resonated with me. And I kind of got it. And then he said another thing. He said that the only thing that he knew of in his 50 years of professional experience that could help people like that was something called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I recoiled at the suggestion, because that was the first time he used the word alcoholic in one of my visits. And, well, a few, you know, months later, as I, you know, lost another job and, you know, things got, you know, more hostile and rough on the home front with, you know, my family and my wife and my young daughter. And I was really having a hard time. I had no work. I had two rents to pay. And I got a letter. You know, I love getting these letters. And this one was, you know, instead of the piles of bills in my kitchen, this letter had a note in it and a check. And the check was for some money that someone had taken from me and not repaid in, you know, one of those nights we were on a mission to get what we needed to get. And the note said, I'm sorry for dealing with you in such an effed up way, but I have found there's a way back from this kind of insane behavior. Those were the very words. And then there was a telephone number. And I didn't know that someone was doing a ninth step. But that ninth step became my 12th step. And he gave me his number. I called him, and he told me that he hadn't had a drink or a drug in 6 months. And did I want to meet him at the meeting on 96th Street called First Things First. And, you know, I told him I had to think about it. I don't know. I got a lot going on. You know, I had a lot going on walking from the kitchen to the bathroom to the bedroom to the telephone. You know, day after day after day, but I did meet him, and I walked into these rooms in, I guess it was about March of 1986, and my last drink was a half a bottle of Budweiser beer. I guess I should just say beer. And, you know, I was ready to give it up. You know, everything I heard there resonated with me, made sense to me. And, You know, in New York, most of our meetings in New York City are speaker meetings, and we also have another format that I love, which is a round robin. So if you like to hide in meetings, it's a good format. I was a person, I didn't say anything for like about the first 40 days. And the whole idea of raising my hand and talking about myself in a personal way was very foreign to me. And I had a lot of shame. I was very shy and withdrawn to begin with. Now, that's what I loved about booze and drugs, is it got me out of that. It gave me the very thing we're talking about here. It gave me sex, security, and society. And it gave me a sense of belonging and a sense of confidence that were missing in me. You know, I was just one of those people walking around. I looked good on the outside, but, you know, inside it was a pretty shaky house of cards that could collapse at any moment. And my reaction to any situation where I felt like I'd failed or I didn't measure up was to withdraw or leave or run away. It happened to me with the graduate degree I went after. It happened to me in, you know, personal close relationships I got into with, some wonderful women who were really clueless about what they were dealing with. And I guess that holds true for my working career, too. You know, if something went wrong, I'd leave. Thanks to great sponsorship and great meetings in New York City where I got sober, you know, I learned how to not pick up a drink a day at a time and work the first three steps. But, once I got 90 days and I actually spoke for the first time on my 90th day, because in my thinking I'd, put $90 in the basket, and that was about the cost of a therapy session, and I thought I'd get my money's worth. I'd spent 3 months listening to a lot of talking, and I didn't say much, but someone said to me, okay, Ken, you got 90 days. You know what you do now? Now you get a service commitment and start going to step meetings. And that's really what made me learn that, staying sober is not just not drinking. It's really about change. And, when I got this letter that said sex, security, and society, I showed it to my wife, and she looked at it, she said, "What the heck does that supposed to mean?" And I said, "I don't know. I better find out quick." And, well, I did a little research, and thank God for this little book, 12 Steps and 12 Traditions, because it's all in here. I love the big book, but, this book you can put in your pocket and take to work. The big book, they got to lop off half of it for you to, travel with. And Bill writes about the instincts in step four. And that's where the words sex, security, and society are found in his essays on the instincts, which, I'm glad I got to read it because they're phenomenal, some of his best writing. And, he talks about how, God, our Creator gives us instincts, for a reason. And as alcoholics, we push those instincts far beyond their limits. In our demands, our expectations, and our reactions. I mean, because I'm demanding, I'm full of expectations. I'm full of fear that those expectations and demands are not going to be met the way I want to. My reaction is resentment, fear, and all kinds of self-centeredness. And my specialty happens to be, self-pity. I excel at self-pity. In fact, one of the things I heard at a meeting, I told my wife, she says it's still the best thing to this day she's ever heard, is someone said, I don't want to stop feeling miserable because it cheers me up. And if you're like that, you're screwed. And, you know, this title of this panel, I mean, these are words that we understand that take on a whole new meaning, as Peggy was talking about. We learn a whole new language. We learn the language of the heart. And that's what drew me immediately. You know, here was a way that I could finally find a voice. I could finally experience before I die and what it's like to be honest and open and willing to let somebody know who I am. And that was just a little glimmer of what it might be like. And as we all know, alcoholism is a progressive disease, and every step and action you take on behalf of sobriety, you know, it's standing there with what they call a pushback, popular word you hear these days. We used to call it backlash. I speak at a meeting. Gee, how come when I get home I feel like crap? You know, I pick up the phone and talk to a sponsee. You know, why do I goof off the rest of the day? I mean, it's, you know, I've learned to live with it. You know, it's just something that if you don't pick up and you hang around long enough, you know, you're going to have to deal with this stuff, or it's going to deal with you, and it's not going to be pretty. For me, you know, when I was in a lot of pain at about 9 months, my sponsor started talking about the fourth step. And I realized that, you know, I had to, like, clear away a lot of crap. I'd use another word. And you know, he gave me these sheets. I guess everybody has seen these sheets, four-step sheets. I call this is the shovel. This is the shovel to start working on it. And it's big. They're big piles in every area. Sex, you make a list of those people. That's not a pretty list. And there's a lot of dishonesty and a lot of behavior that, you know, if you want to be honest about it, maybe the word abuse is appropriate in some cases. Certainly selfish, that seems to apply. I know that, you know, in dealing with all areas of my life, as this step asks you to do, you know, and we ransack memory, as the book says, and we're thorough, and we try to look at every part of our life, scan the searchlight over our past, as Bill writes. It's work, and that's why this work is put in the chapter called Into Action. So it's, you know, this was my shovel. I preferred, you know, just a regular piece of paper. This works for me. I mean, this is a little too complicated for me. And I don't have experience in a rehab or a detox. I got sober in meetings, and that worked for me. And I'd love to spend 4 weeks at the Meadows or Hazelden, but, you know, maybe someday I will. So, not for the reason you're thinking. So I've been fortunate to have great sponsorship that's been very confrontational, not hand-holding, tough, and loving. You know, I'm not a big on tough love. I was for a while, but the longer I stick around, you know, the more I think this is a loving thing we're involved in. It's a gentle, loving thing. And this is hard stuff. We need help to look at these things. We need a lot of support and a lot of trust to start talking about these relationships that we've been through. You know, and the big aha moment for me was that, you know, when I went over my list of fears and resentments and bad relationships and, you know, things that had gone wrong in my life, you know, the big revelation was it wasn't about them. It never was about them. You know, all these grudges and you know, rational, you know, reasons to be PO'd at all these people in my life, beginning with mom and dad, really was had nothing to do with them anymore. That I had this opportunity, you know, to look at me and really start the work of change. And I think that it's an ongoing process. I remarried 14 years ago, and I have a 12-year-old son who I love my family very much. And, you know, it hasn't been easy for them or for me. I don't recommend getting married in sobriety. It's can I take that back? No, it's a beautiful thing to have a family, but the challenge is to practice these principles in all our affairs at home and outside of the home. And it's thank God they're still around. My wife and my son, you know, I treasure them. But, you know, I put them through some hell. And but I'm growing up, and I, a day at a time, with the help of this program. And every day, I have to get sober every day again. I've learned that. I have to get sober as a husband, as a worker. And I'm still trying to get sober as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, service is still the ticket for that. This has been a wonderful opportunity to say thank you to you guys for giving me a life and for teaching me how to get through life, you know, as a grown man. Sober. Not just drinking, but sober. So thank you very much.
Okay, our next speaker is Sarah from New York.
Hi, everybody. My name is Sarah. I'm an alcoholic. My home group is the Promises Meeting at 5th Avenue and 55th Street in New York City. You all are welcome any Friday between 12:30 and 1:30. Love to see you there. And my sobriety date is July 14th, Bastille Day, 1981. So sex, security, and society. That's an interesting series of S's. And I was thinking about what the Big Book says. Our stories disclose in a general way what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. So I was thinking, 28 years later, I would probably still know something about having sex. But I would certainly not know anything about security or society as I have come to understand it in my recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. So what it was like, after 19 years of drinking, having been born and raised in New York City, I was living on a tropical island underneath a palm tree with a pirate whose motto for life was, "We're not here for a long time, we're here for a good time." And I thought, that suits me just fine. I hadn't noticed that I had walked away from one of the most successful jobs on the island because it interfered with my drinking. And I hadn't noticed that I had failed to maintain any meaningful relationships with anyone in my family. As far as society was concerned, with an apology to my dear friends from St. Croix who are in the room today, and I will add that not only are there wonderful people on that island, there are long sober people, none of whom I knew. And society, as far as I was concerned, was consisting of louts, layabouts, and thieves. I found them colorful. It was actually an inside-out introduction to AA because everyone was anonymous. People were hiding, people were fleeing, people were running from the NYPD, the MRS, the IRS. No one had a last name. It was even hard to find where people lived. We all lived in beautiful places, but it was like, oh yeah, Sarah, isn't she the one who lived in that great house? Three mailboxes past the dumpster on that dirt road with the chickens. It was the frontier. And for me, it was a sexual frontier, a security frontier, and a societal frontier, but not in the ways you might imagine. I'm with my pirate, who was an absolutely wonderful man who actually died a couple of years ago, and I always longed for him to find AA, simply because even if he didn't want to get sober, which he didn't, he was a terrific storyteller. So he would have been so happy with an unlimited opportunity to tell his various stories. But I have to pay him a debt of gratitude, because if he hadn't taught me so much about sex, drugs, and alcohol, I might not be here today. I'll drink your water. The very thought of it makes me thirsty. So anyway, as far as society was concerned, it was people, to be polite, of low degree. Now, as I said, there are marvelous people on St. Croix, many of whom are in the room today, and some are dear friends in sobriety. But at the time, I can assure you, I knew no one who didn't drink exactly the way all of us did. And when people would come down on holiday and they would take a look at how we lived and they would say, you know, we're here on vacation, drinking around the clock, having a great time, doing all these things, but what is it like for you who live here? And we would all just look at each other, because that's exactly what we were doing too, only we lived there. All right, so you can imagine that the concept of security in a place like this was really limited to the badge on the shoulder of the guy at the airport, security. And when you move back from that, as I was thinking the other day, what does security mean to a group of people who voluntarily go to live on a pin dot in the middle of an ocean constantly beset by hurricanes? Security was not high on my list of goals. And as far as sex was concerned, at least in my crowd on the island, sex was considered an activity or a sport. It was like swimming or sailing or tennis. It was something you chose to do as opposed to something else. And like all good sports, you had to practice. So basically, we had a lot of fun, and I am one of those alcoholics who actually had a lot of fun while I was drinking, but there came a point where, just like all of you, it did not work anymore. And one of the great miracles for me in my own recovery is how I ever got off that island. I had not broken any bones. I had not set any houses on fire. But as I told you, in my pursuit of a good time, long time, good time, I had really walked away not only from my family and a job, but all of the standards that I had lived by growing up before I became dependent every day on drinking. And I didn't see it as a dependence, because it was what I did. It was like air. And I hear that so often in meetings. We just couldn't imagine living any other way. And so when it occurred to me that maybe something was wrong with my life, it wasn't about society or security, or really even too much about sex, a bit. It was that I felt I needed a job. Now, I was completely unemployable, so this was a kind of an interesting concept, but I left to go back to New York to get a job. And I lasted precisely 6 weeks in New York City with the habits that I had picked up in the Virgin Islands before I was 12-stepped into Alcoholics Anonymous. At which point, I figured I'm really not interested in stopping drinking on any kind of long-term basis, but it probably would help me get a job. So I started doing what the woman who had 12-stepped me told me to do, and she came from the do as I say, do as I do, don't even think about doing anything different school of sponsorship. And as a result, I, for once in my life, did everything I was told. So I went to a meeting every day. I hung out with people from AA. It took about 3 weeks for me to start flirting with another one of her sponsees. We ran off together on an illicit tryst because, of course, we were supposed to make not only no major changes in the first year, but it was understood that if you were going to be doing anything like that, you certainly didn't do it with someone else who was also under the eye of your sponsor. So I got a really good early lesson in my first few weeks in sobriety when, of course, we were seen somewhere by someone in the rooms who immediately reported to my sponsor that I was out there breaking the law of having sex within my first 90 days. At which point I thought, what am I supposed to learn about this after 90 days that I don't already know now? But in any event, we were reported, and as a result, my sponsor called up and said, I'll make this very easy. You either drop the relationship or you get another sponsor. And I went, wow, this is serious. So I did. I stayed with that sponsor for a number of months and then went on to be the beneficiary, as Peggy and Ken have both said, of really wonderful sponsorship through my time in AA. But just because I stopped drinking, sex, security, and society did not immediately fall into place. I was blessed by being on a pink cloud for at least 2 years, and I've come to see that my understanding of security and society were completely interrelated because really and truly, as my beloved sister often says, my feet were firmly planted in midair. That was security for me. And what made me feel secure all through my life, and even into the first years of my drinking, or my recovery from drinking, what made me feel secure was whatever I saw in your eyes. My goal was to be thought well of by you. So when I was drinking, I wanted to be the best drinker. And frankly, I didn't miss it by much. I was a gifted drinker. I was really good at it. I had a hollow leg. I was completely democratic. I would drink high, low, and in between. And so when I stopped to think about it, my sense of society was really being thought well of in a big group of people. So I wanted all of you to think that I was just fabulous. In fact, when I got sober in New York, we were often cautioned about being too hungry, angry, lonely, or tired. And for me, they added, or fabulous. And as I heard someone say not long ago, being fabulous is totally overrated and expensive. So fabulous didn't really work as I began to understand more and more about honesty and really trying to figure out who I was. And so I first realized that if all of my self-esteem and my sense of security is in your eyes, what happens when you blink or leave the room? where am I? And that's when I began to realize feet firmly planted in midair. And I did the things that I was supposed to do. I went to meetings, I did service, all of that. And pretty soon, I began to hear about the steps. And I loved all the God steps. It felt like somebody was doing it for me, which in fact was true. When I got to the fourth step, I thought, uh-oh, I don't get this at all. In the first place, a defect is something I don't want to find in my new TV. I had no concept of a defect in my person, which is so much denial. I really, it's embarrassing to admit. But as a result, I kept postponing my fourth step. Postponed it from the first year to the second year, the second year to the third year, the third year to the fourth year. And when I was in my fourth year of sobriety, I had a wonderful sponsor. I was surrounded all the time by AA people. And I knew this much about honesty and authenticity, that I couldn't raise my hand and say that I had 5 years of sobriety if I hadn't done a fourth step. So I sat down and I wrote out a huge resentment list. It was nothing about the solution. It was nothing about trying to figure out my part in things. Oh, no. It was everything that anyone had ever done to bother me or might ever do. I included that. Trying to plan ahead a little. So I was able to raise my hand in the sense that I felt like I had done something that you would approve of. But even then, the only thing that motivated my fourth step was kind of keeping up with all the Joneses in AA. It wasn't at all about what is it about me that I need to change in order to live the kind of life that we get to live here. So I bounced along for the next few years, and I got really good at resentments. And I was always trying to figure out what people meant about self-esteem and the security and the worker among workers. And I would read these words over and over again, but I had to personally encounter so much ego deflation at depth. Don't you love that phrase? Ego deflation at depth. Bill had such a way with words. Every time I pick up the 12 and 12, which I adore, and I open it to the first step, and I read the first line, I think, who cares to admit complete defeat? Practically no one, of course. And I thought, there isn't a literary agent in the country who would take that book as it is and try to sell it. Who cares to admit complete defeat? And yet, that's the key. That is the key. And in my first 5 years, I really came to understand a lot about the first step, which in my view is the only one that we need to take perfectly every day. So I bounced along on my journey, adding the meetings, the sober time, listening to people, many, many, many meetings. A friend said to me recently, Sarah, there's no substitute for time spent. Think about the Grand Canyon. Drip, 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 drip. It's just drips of water over millennia. And that is what, in the most wonderful way, sobriety has been for me. Just sitting in the rooms, listening to people, and eventually I would have like a little aha. Oh, this must be what they mean. Oh, maybe I should read that. Oh, I should talk to so-and-so. Oh, maybe it's time for me to go back to St. Croix and sit down with Flash, who always gives me the 1-2 punch around my sobriety. And eventually, just like the Grand Canyon drip, 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 it began to inhabit me. Sobriety was not something I was working for. It was something that came delivered to me slowly and surely in the most beautiful way. I was blessed with having a 10-year relationship with someone also in recovery. And when that relationship ended, in a very sober way, I started bouncing off the walls. I was about 15 years sober, and I got into one of those marvelous self-will-run riot sexual relationships. And it really almost undid me. I knew it was not the right thing to do, and I truly felt powerless to do anything about it. Sex was a big part of it, and society and security were at best disapproving or non-existent. And it took me really sort of like God got me up by the neck and said, you know, what are you doing? And I was able to come out of the other side of that with nobody picking up a drink and everything okay, except it plunged me into a terrible place in my recovery. I was really practiced then in being a sober, living woman. I knew how to do all the things, go to meetings, give the service, work the steps. But somehow I was in such a dark, dark place that I tried everything. And slowly but surely, I came around and I realized that something amazing had happened to me. Blame had mostly left my life. Blame had mostly disappeared. I found to my amazement that I was no longer making other people responsible for everything that I did or felt or that happened to me. The other day I was on my way to a meeting. I was running a little bit late, and I stopped on the street to have some words with someone I knew, a quick hello. And when I went down into the subway, the train that I needed to be on time to my meeting was pulling out of the station. And I thought to myself, 10 years ago, I would have blamed that on the person I had just been talking to. That's how deeply rooted it was in me. And when I realized that blame, finding others responsible, had so far diminished from my walking through my life, I began to be secure. Because I knew that I could count on myself, my recovery, my God, my program. And what followed after that was a sense of belonging unlike any that I had experienced up until that time. I think I also got a little nicer, and I know that I felt more authentic. So I thought about something that a wonderful man who is no longer here except in spirit, who worked at the General Service Office, Frank M., who ran the archive. One day I was in terrible trouble, and I was talking to Frank, and whatever my big problem was, he listened the way you all always do. He listened, and finally when I stopped ranting, he paused and he said, you know, Sarah, I think it's time for you to learn the secret. Now, he was sober much longer than I, and I thought, this is what I've been waiting for. Somebody is going to give me the secret. So I held the phone to my ear and I said, Frank, what is it? And he said, it is this, Sarah. Begin where you are. Do what you can gracefully. Step out in faith. Expect God to help. And that has never failed me in terms of sex, security, or society. And I pass it on to you today in the hope that it may also serve you. Thank you.
Thanks so much. I know people are hungry, and this is supposed to end at 1 o'clock, but since we started late, maybe we can end early and I can break all the rules. One thing I would like to do in closing, and this is, I hope this doesn't ruffle any feathers, but if it does, talk to your sponsor or write inventory. I would like to close this meeting the way my home group closes, and that's with the third step prayer. And I know a lot of you know it.